I was woken by the bedside telephone. You need to check out of your hotel immediately, said Amelia. Things have changed. There's a car on the way. I didn't argue. I couldn't. She'd gone. I pulled back the curtains to unveil a sky and sea as grey as death. Nothing was stirring. Just as I was about to turn away, I heard the sound of an engine. I looked down and saw a couple of cars pull up. The doors of the first opened and two young men got out. Young, fit-looking, wearing ski jackets, jeans and boots. The driver stared up at my window and instinctively I took a step backwards. By the time I risked a second look, he had opened the rear of the car and was taking out a television camera. I started to move quickly then, showered, shaved, put on clean clothes and packed. By the time I got down to reception, the hotel looked as if it was staging an international media convention. I passed, unnoticed, through the crowds and went outside to the veranda. The minivan took me up the hill, out of Edgartown and into the flat countryside. As we approached the Reinhardt compound, the driver leaned in close to the windscreen. Here we go again. Up ahead, it looked as though there had been a traffic accident. The vivid blue lights of a couple of patrol cars flashed dramatically in the gloomy morning. People were standing around aimlessly, and I assumed that they had been in a pile-up. But as the minivan slowed and indicated to turn left, the bystanders started grabbing things from beside the road and came running at us. Lang! 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 A woman shouted over a bullhorn. Liar! 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 Images of Lang in an orange jumpsuit, gripping prison bars with bloodied hands, danced in front of the windscreen. Wanted war criminal, Adam Lang. They're always the really violent bastards, said my driver. Peace protesters. He put his foot down. The rear tyres slithered uselessly, then bit, and we shot forwards into the silent woods. Amelia met me in the passage, and I trailed behind her around to the back of the house. I tried to call you several times last night, she said, but you didn't answer. What did you want to tell me? This. She stopped outside a door, opened it, and stood aside to let me go in. The room was in darkness, but there was just enough light for me to make out the shape of a double bed. It smelled of stale clothes and old lady's soap. You'll be sleeping in here from now on. I tried to make a joke of it. Is this where you put the granny? No, this is where we put Mike Macara. I've never been particularly superstitious, but I do believe that certain places have an atmosphere, and from the moment I stepped into that room, I didn't like it. The thought of touching Makara's clothes filled me with something close to panic. Look, she said, we're due to get the ICC announcement in less than 30 minutes. Why don't you settle in here, then come up and join us? Whatever's decided will affect you. You're practically one of us now. I am? Of course. You drafted the statement yesterday. That makes you an accomplice. Down below, I heard the noise of the minivan pulling up outside the front of the house. There was a commotion of voices in the hall, and then a small army of footsteps thudding up the wooden staircase. I reckon that must be the sound of $1,000 an hour in legal fees on the hoof. I gave Kroll and his client a couple of minutes for handshakes, condolences, and general expressions of confidence, then wearily left my dead man's room and went up to join them. Kroll had flown in by private jet from Washington with two young paralegals, an exquisitely pretty Mexican woman he introduced as Encarnacion, and a black guy from New York called Josh. So here's the score, said Kroll, when we'd all taken our places. You're not being charged, you're not being arrested. All that the prosecutor is asking for right now is permission to launch a formal investigation. So when you go out of here, you walk tall, you look cool, and you have peace in your heart because it's all going to be fine. The president told me he thought they might not even let her investigate, said Lang. I hesitate to contradict the leader of the free world, said Kroll, but the general feeling in Washington this morning is they'll have to. Madam Prosecutor is quite a savvy operator, it seems. The British government have consistently refused to hold an investigation of their own, which gives her a legal pretext to look at it herself. What am I likely to be investigated for? Kroll gestured to Encarnacion. Either crimes against humanity, she said carefully, or war crimes. There was a silence. Odd, the effect such words can have. Unbelievable. said Ruth eventually, to equate what Adam did or didn't do with the Nazis. That's precisely why the United States doesn't recognize the court, said Krull. He wagged his finger. We warned you what would happen. An international war crimes tribunal sounds very noble in principle. But you go after all these genocidal maniacs in the Third World, and sooner or later the Third World is going to come right back after you. Otherwise, it looks like discrimination. Well, they can't drag America into their phony court. So who can they drag? It's obvious. Our closest ally, you. It's not legal. It's political. Ruth was concentrating hard, and now she shook her head emphatically. No, Sid, it's legal as well. Richard Reichardt has produced documentary evidence which suggests that Adam did, in fact, do all those things. Aided, abetted, and facilitated. She looked up. This is legal jeopardy, and that leads inescapably to political jeopardy. Well, if it's any comfort, Adam's certainly not in jeopardy as long as he stays here among his friends. Wait a minute, said Lang, raising his hand to his head and clutching his hair, as if he were glimpsing the situation for the first time. Are you saying that I can't leave the United States? Until this whole thing is resolved, said Krull, I do strongly advise you not to travel to any country that recognizes the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. But just about every country in the world recognizes the ICC, said Lang. America doesn't. And who else? Iraq, said Josh. China. North Korea. Indonesia. We waited for him to go on. He didn't. Amelia aimed the remote at the television. I think something's happening, she said. I'd never witnessed any of my authors at a real crisis in their lives before. And scrutinizing Lang, I gradually began to realize that the question, how did it feel, was a crude tool. In the course of those few minutes, a rapid succession of emotions swept across Lang's face. Shock, fury, hurt, defiance, dismay, shame. How were these to be disentangled? And if he didn't know precisely what he was feeling now, how could he be expected to remember in 10 years' time? The chief prosecutor finished her statement, and the screen reverted to the aerial shot of Reinhardt's house in its setting of woods, pond and ocean. As the world waited for Lang to appear, downstairs, the phones started ringing. We should get you to Washington, said Krull. My plane's waiting at the airport. Lang was still staring at the screen. When Marty said I could use his vacation house, I never realized how cut off this place was. Oh, we should never have come. Now we look as though we're hiding. Exactly my feeling, said Krull. You can't just hole up here. I've made some calls. I can get you in to see the House Majority Leader at lunchtime. We can have a photo op with the Secretary of State this afternoon. With Lang and the others gone, the house seemed not merely empty, but bereft of purpose. I recognized I was now at a decisive point. Either I continued to hang around the edges of this floundering project, or I could seize control of it myself. Knock these 621 pages into some kind of publishable shape, take my 250 grand and head off to lie on a beach somewhere until I had forgotten all about the Langs. But in those terms, it wasn't a choice. I picked up Makara's manuscript to remind myself of how not to begin a $10 million autobiography. Chapter 1. Early Years. Langs are Scottish folk originally and proud of it. Our name is a derivation of long, the old English word for tall, and it is from the north of the border that my forefathers hail. God help us. I ran my pen through it. If you want a family tree, go to a garden centre. That's what I advise my clients. Nobody else is interested. I turned my attention to the interview transcripts. I knew what I wanted. It was there in our first session. If I tidied up the grammar, the account of how Ruth had canvassed Lang for the local elections and so drawn him into politics would make a perfect opening. I rested my fingers on the keys of my laptop and started to type. I became a politician out of love, Not love for any particular party or ideology, but love for a woman who came knocking on my door one wet Sunday afternoon. I carried on for a couple of hours until about 1 o'clock or so, then turned to face my room. I knew I couldn't put it off any longer. It was time to clear away Makara's clothes. Taking a deep breath, I slid open the doors to the closet and reached up to the shelf above the clothes rail to pull down his suitcase. It hit the floor with a thud and the catches flew up with a loud and simultaneous snap. Inside was a single large padded envelope addressed to M. Makara, Esquire. A label on the back showed it had come from the Adam Lang Archive Centre in Cambridge. I turned it over in my hands for a second, then opened it and pulled out a handful of photographs and photocopies. The photocopies were of various footlights programmes and theatre reviews from Cambridge, plus a lot of local newspaper reports of the Greater London Council elections of May 1977, and Lang's original party membership card. It was only when I saw the date on the card that I rocked back on my heels. It was from 1975, 2 years before Ruth had come knocking on the door. I was more irritated than anything. It certainly didn't strike me as sinister. Everybody tends to heighten their own reality, and I could see how it would have suited Lang to pretend he'd only gone into politics because he fancied a girl. I turned my attention back to the Cambridge material. The biggest of the photographs showed 8 young people grouped together under a spotlight, their arms outstretched, as if they'd just finished some show-stopping song and dance routine in a cabaret. Lang was on the far right, wearing a striped blazer, a bow tie and a straw boater. Glued to the back was a typed slip listing the names of the performers along with their colleges. There was a copyright stamp, Cambridge Evening News, in the bottom left-hand corner, and scrawled diagonally next to it, in blue biro, was a telephone number. No doubt Makara, indefatigable fact-hound that he was, had hunted down one of the cast, and I wondered which one of them it was, and if he or she could remember the events depicted in the photographs. Purely on a whim, I took out my mobile and dialed the number. I let it ring for a long while. Just as I was about to give up, a man answered, cautiously. "Richard Reichardt?" I hung up at once. In fact, I was so alarmed, I actually threw the phone onto the bed. It lay there for about 30 seconds, and then it started to ring. I darted over and grabbed it. The incoming number was withheld and quickly switched it off. Suddenly, I couldn't rid my mind of the image of Makara's heavy body rolling back and forth in the surf. I went downstairs to find the housekeeper. "Excuse me, Depp."
"Yes, sir."
"Do you happen to know if there's a map of the island I could borrow?"